Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, you know the drill. We're recording on Thursday morning, but the show will air on Good Friday. I am not religious. I am probably either an atheist or an agnostic, although I was on my way to divinity school, so you can tell it's been an interesting arc for me. I grew up in a Jewish-Italian neighborhood. I actually went to Hebrew school for a while. I studied Judaism's influence on Israeli politics in 1972 when I was living outside of the Jaffa Gate. So a religion and the planet and this sense of responsibility is something that has been embedded in my life. And I guess you might even call it a sense of generational ethics. And as I was thinking about that, I read a statement by William Shatner. And as you remember, you know, we all know about Star Trek, but then he actually got to go up on a jet, whatever those things are called that go up in the air, on a spaceship, and actually get to see the planet, something that he had been artificially imagining, but then he actually got to see it. And he wrote this amazing, amazing statement. And I recommend that if you know someone who is going to be providing a service on Sunday, you might want to share it with them, because I think it's something that should be read on Easter Sunday. And this is what William Shatner wrote. Last year, this is written, I guess, in 2022. Last year, I had a life-changing experience at the age of 90. I went to space. After decades of playing an iconic science fiction character who is exploring the universe, I thought I would experience a deep connection with this immensity around us, a deep call for endless exploration. I was absolutely wrong. The strongest feeling that dominated everything else by far was the deepest grief that I had ever experienced. I understood in the clearest possible way that we were living on a tiny oasis of life, surrounded by an immensity of death. I didn't see infinite possibilities of worlds to explore, of adventures to have, or living creatures to connect with. I saw the deepest darkness I could have ever imagined, contrasting so starkly with the welcoming warmth of our nurturing home planet. This was an immensely powerful awakening for me. It filled me with sadness. I realized that we had spent decades, if not centuries, being obsessed with looking away, with looking outside. I did my share in popularizing that idea that space was the final frontier. But I had to get to space to understand that Earth is and will stay our only home, and that we have been ravaging it relentlessly, making it uninhabitable. William Shatner, actor. I read that and I just started to cry because how profound and how important. And again, it's something that we all need to sort of share with each other. And if you go to temple, you go to church, or you go to a mosque, you might want to find someone to read it to you. Joining me right now is Harvey Kronberg. He is the publisher of the Quorum Report. And as I said, on Fridays, it's all Texas all the time, Harvey. And we have been doing this with Scott Braddock of the Quorum Report since Rick Perry was running for president and was under indictment at the time he was running for president. And I reached out to some folks at KPFT and I said, I want to cover someone like who can tell me about Texas and Rick Perry. And they said, oh, we got this guy we know. You might want to call him, you know? And I'm like, sure. And we called Scott Braddock, and originally the first, I think, year of the show, we called it Indictment Watch. But we have moved so far beyond that, I can't possibly imagine. But Harvey, thank you so much for joining us. There's so much to talk about when it comes to Texas. I actually saw a story just before we were coming on the air, and I shared it with you really quickly, that there was a piece at Newsweek, Texas's secession closer than anyone thinks. And I was like, oh my God. But before we get into secession, I want to talk a little bit about what you said to me, which I thought was so interesting. And it's about the credentials for the 2024 Texas Republican Convention in San Antonio, Texas, which will be held on May 20th through the 25th. And as someone who's actually covered conventions, as someone who's actually spoken at conventions, as someone who's been credentialed for conventions, I'm always sort of interested and curious. But from your perspective, as a fairly interesting and provocative truth teller in Texas with the Quorum Report, I thought it was fascinating that you wanted to show me what it was that you needed to produce for media access. And I am going to read the 5 points, but then I want you to focus on what you told me to focus on, which immediately jumped off the page. And that was number 4. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read the 5 and then let's focus on number 4. This is what they expect if you are going to get media access. 1, you must complete the Republican Party of Texas's application for media accreditation. 2, you must present the Republican Party of Texas with an official government photo ID. 3, you must present to the Republican Party of Texas with an official photo identification card issued by their news organization or a letter from their employer or an official letterhead verifying their current employment as a journalist. 4, this is the interesting language, pay attention everyone, present the Republican Party of Texas with sufficient evidence, parentheses, not business cards or membership cards from communications or writer organizations, close paren, to demonstrate eligibility and purpose, including evidence that attendance is expected to result in, quote, factual coverage of the meeting in print, broadcast, or internet media. Example, demonstrated writings about the Republican Party of Texas or related political issues in the previous year. And finalmente, number 5, behave in a professional manner at all times. I recognize 3 of the 5. Okay. The idea that somebody would ask me to behave in a professional manner I've never seen before, but you know, maybe that was wallpaper. I assume that, but maybe you need to say that right now. But number 4 was what you wanted me to focus on. And clearly, as soon as I read it, I went, what the F does this mean? Because if I've ever read anything in my life that seemed arbitrary and capricious and would allow the RPT, the Republican Party of Texas, to make a decision, not necessarily on your history in the media, your accurate representation in the media, your knowledge of Texas, but it would make an opportunity for them to be the interesting gatekeeper and possibly prevent folks from actually getting the credentials they need. So you know your state, you've been covering Texas for decades. Let's talk a little bit about this and why is this language inserted and what kind of fear does it present for you and other media sources about what the Republican Party of Texas is attempting to do?
Well, let's first point out that 6 weeks ago, the Republican Party of Texas sent out its normal historical credential application, nothing controversial about it. We filled it out. 6 weeks later, they apparently decided after the primaries that the governor lying routinely was going into districts and looking in the camera and saying, I can't trust this guy on the border, or he helped fund what he would call illegals going to public schools. That, by the way, is the budget. It's mandated that we do that. Mm-hmm. But after all the coverage they've gotten on that, apparently they've decided that they want to sanitize the copy. It's frankly baffling. So I'm going to send them the coverage of the last state Republican convention, in which Cornyn, our senior senator, was booed for 25 of the 30 minutes.
I remember
such
that
a scary convention that Greg Abbott refused to go into the hall. The leader of the Republican Party was intimidated and was afraid he was going to be booed, and his only presence at the convention was at a reception in Houston, about a mile from the convention center, 105 degree temperatures, single file to get in. People were passing out in the line to get in. And that was all factual reporting, but I'm not sure that would pass muster today.
So let me just remind everyone, the reason why you want to share the information about the governor not telling the truth during the primary is, let's remind everyone what the governor was doing. The governor was actually taking a page out of Governor Reynolds' book from Iowa. And that was, Governor Reynolds wanted to pass vouchers in Iowa, but rural Republicans weren't accommodating to her decision to pass vouchers. So what did Governor Reynolds do in Iowa? She went into the primary. She cherry picked the Republicans that were anti-voucher. She then proceeded to make sure that she put money, support, whatever she wanted to do to make sure that they would lose their primary and only pro-voucher Republicans would win a primary. Well, that was Governor Reynolds. I'm not sure she lied in the Republican primary, but she definitely targeted anti-voucher Republicans, which were basically rural Republicans. Let's now fast forward to the primary in Texas, which you have so clearly taught me And Harvey, what you see is the governor of Texas doing the same thing, going into Republican primaries, especially in rural areas, and basically targeting anti-voucher Republicans. What you are saying, however, is more interesting because you are not just saying that he targeted these anti-voucher Republicans. You are saying he misled the public, aka lied, okay, about these Republicans. And you reported what was true and what was not. And therefore, because you were accurate in your representation, you may now have offended the governor because no one likes to be called a liar even when they lie. And now the question becomes, because they sent out this new application for the Republican Party of Texas convention and that Section 4, will your accurate description of what the governor did during the primary actually cut you off at the knees and make it impossible for you to get the kind of credentials you would need to be able to accurately report what happens at this convention?
In effect, apparently, what it looks like is that we're supposed to report press releases,
Right.
and of course, there's no value to that, and the press releases are just as misleading as the governor. Let me put one final note on what the governor did. When you run for office, you expect to, the truth is always the first casualty. You expect to be lied about, but this was a different order of magnitude. He cut commercials that ran nonstop, specifically looking in the camera, lying about people who had supported him on everything but vouchers, and then miss. For instance, I was talking about funding for public immigrants in public schools. It's mandated by federal law that we do so. He signed it. It's in the budget. And there's multiple cases where he looked in the camera and bills that he signed, he lied about what the state rep had done. The governor looking in the camera lying is very different than anonymous mail or grainy voiceovers or that kind of thing. He's at the peak of his popularity in Texas Republican Party now, never been this popular before, and it's all based on his actions and optics on the border.
And also, my understanding is he has more money than the National Republican Party, which right now is probably a very easy thing to do since the National Republican Party is actually feeding all their money into Donald Trump's legal woes. But he's sitting on mountains of cash. So not only do you have a well-known popular governor who's bringing his face and his image to the TV screen, but he has millions and millions and millions of dollars. And we're talking about little tchotchke races in rural parts of Texas. I mean, I don't know what it's like to run for the legislature in Texas. I was one of 400 in New Hampshire running for the legislature. I think if I spent $250, it was a lot. And if anyone suddenly showed up in my district and started spending like a thousand, I'd be like, oh my God. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about an order of magnitude, as you point out, which is astronomical. And your biggest fear here in this number four, where they expect you to provide evidence that resulted in factual coverage, I guess my question is, how do they define the term fact? That's the problem.
We're going to find out who makes the cut.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
yeah. Typically, by this time, by the way, the press has already made, we've got a block of rooms at the convention hotel. So it's the convention floor is much less consequential than the bar at the convention hotel. And so whether obviously they don't want us at the convention hotel, they're not going to keep us out of the convention hotel, which is really where you find out what's going on. But
Right.
being able to visually watch John Cornyn get booed for 25 minutes, and by the way, Ken Paxton looks like he's going to be running against him, is some you have to experience that to understand how angry the Republican Party is, was and probably still is.
So, real quick, just as an aside, back in right after the 9/11, I went to the Republican convention, the National Republican Convention in New York City. Okay, this is right after 9/11. And just to let you know how important it is to visually and physically be there, it's really, really important. And I'm doing morning drive time radio, and we're doing it live from the floor of the convention. And who is my first guest but Newt Gingrich? Okay. And you know, when you don't like each other, you get within like an inch of each other's nose. I mean, we're like right there. And I had gone in and seen on the floor of the convention three podiums, and the podiums were made of wood. And inlaid in the podiums, in the wood, appeared to be crosses in each one of the centers of the podiums. So I mentioned this to Mr. Gingrich, and I said, "What the hell is this convention about?" And here's what Newt said to me: "Oh, Arnie, Two words, under God. Now you know why it's important to be at a convention. Okay, you want to physically be there. All right, let's talk a little bit about what else.
One last intersection that you might enjoy.
Yeah, I love it.
The original seed money for Abbott's efforts was $6 million, contributed by a guy named Jeff Yass. In the state of Texas, he has banned TikTok on all government phones. Jeff Yass is one of the primary investors, initial investors in TikTok. So TikTok money, TikTok is not good enough for state phones, but their money is obviously good enough to take out rural Republicans.
Well, my understanding also is about Jeff Yass is that apparently he and Donald Trump have now had a come to Jesus moment. And Donald Trump used to be against TikTok and banning TikTok. And then all of a sudden we have, as someone said, this is an interesting article. You might want to check it out at the American Prospect. It's entitled The Corrupt Trifecta of Yass, Trump, and Netanyahu. Ooh, it's getting more interesting by the minute. And you just mentioned Yass and the money he gave to Abbott. So again, every time you turn, Yass apparently is like an octopus. He's got lots of money. And every time he puts his arm out, there's a couple of million right there with every arm. All right. So thank you again for adding Yass to the conversation. I didn't know about Yass and Abbott, but I'm going to make sure other people do. Let's talk a little bit also. This sounds really quirky, but all right. You mentioned that it looks like Ken Paxton is going to probably run against John Cornyn. That's what you're suggesting. What I don't understand is how did the AG reach a deal to end his securities fraud charge after 9 years? I mean, they kept this sucker alive for 9 years. And then suddenly, after he beats impeachment, and all of a sudden we're now talking about him possibly running against Cornyn, all of a sudden, after 9 freaking years, they drop the charges. Explain to me what's going on that I'm not seeing.
Essentially what it boiled down to was that the case was in his home county, Collin County. The prosecutor was friendly with him. It was determined that he needed to have a special prosecutors. Collin County Commissioner's Court hired two guys and then essentially refused to pay them. It got stuck in appeals court, which of course for 3 years. It's a securities fraud case, and it involves signed documents. Well, all the evidence is stale, frankly. One of the attorneys got married, made a bunch of money, is thinking about leaving the law. The second one, left by himself, said, I will pro bono cases for widows, orphans, but I'm not going to do it to take out a corrupt public official. I'm not going to bear the cost of that. So they had technically a win. That was $300,000 settlement to make the victims whole after 3 years. He's got to take 15 hours of ethics courses.
Can I be his teacher? I want to be his teacher. If he's going to teach ethics courses, then I got to teach it. All right. So and then he's got some community service, right?
yes, but frankly, it was the weakest of the three legal challenges that that Paxton faces. We still have the whistleblower lawsuit, which in which
That's
he is
right.
going to, if he ever is forced into deposition, it's now in the hands of the Texas Supreme Court. He will have to, if he testifies, he will have to take the fifth. And the developer that he was helping is supposed to report for 10 days in jail for contempt. And I think 10 days in jail might clarify the mind a little bit.
Wow.
There's that legal thread, and the grand jury in San Antonio looking at his abuses of power is still in play, but sadly we know how slow Merrick Garland operates. And the case is, as I understand it, and of course there's a lot of secrecy shrouded about it, but there are indictments that will be forthcoming, but the closer we get to the election, the more likely they are to be postponed.
Oh God, oh God. But can you imagine? If I were Cornyn, I'd be running against Ken Paxton wearing an orange jumpsuit.
Did you
I'm
see
going.
the well did you see the Twitter exchange?
No, I
Oh,
missed
so
him.
Paxton, which essentially it was his candidacy announcement. He says, why would the Republicans accept as a leader? As you know, John Cornyn is in competition to replace Mitch McConnell as Senate leader, a Republican leader. Said, why would Republicans go for accept as leader a someone soft on guns, abortion, and whatever? And within 15 minutes, John Cornyn, and I tell you, this was not staff. It was not sanitized at all. He said, have fun now, Ken. It's going to be difficult to text from prison.
That's right. I see. I tell you, I Cornyn, you were like we're on the same page. I'm not surprised. You can tell there's politics in my blood. All right. So, and then I'm this, but this is the quirky one. The reason I put it in is that everybody loves Willie Nelson. I mean, everybody loves Willie Nelson. And my understanding is that for almost 50 years, Willie Nelson has had a huge 4th of July concert in Texas. Well,
Yep.
Willie Nelson is doing something that is really flipping the bird at Texas, because not only is he taking his huge annual event out of Texas, but he's taking it to Pennsylvania, which I thought was so fascinating. What has been the reaction in Texas? I mean, again, Willie is beloved. He is beloved, but he is so disgusted by what he is seeing, and so much negativity and so much cruelty, frankly, that I'm pleased, but at the same time, I'm kind of curious as to how folks in Texas are responding.
Well, there's a certain predictability to this because obviously we have become a draconian social authoritarian state over the course of the last 2 years, and there's no evidence of that easing up in any way, shape, or form. And I'm proud to say that I have the poster from the first Willie Nelson
You'll have to
4th of
send me
July.
a picture. All right, keep going.
But anyway, he has not made a political statement per se, but my guess, just knowing the people around Willie Nelson, is that Pennsylvania is a swing state, and
Yes.
that having this kind of statement, 4th of July, people aren't
Yes.
paying attention to politics, but there will be a subtext message coming out. But it
Wow.
is pretty amazing
It
because
is.
Willie Nelson has essentially put Texas on the map and Austin on the map as the music capital of the world. Austin City Limits would not have prospered without Willie Nelson. It's the longest running program on PBS.
Thanks.
And of course, I've been here so long. There were days I might have gone for adult beverages, and there'd be a guy up on stage, some guy that had just come from Nashville named Nelson that was just strumming on the guitar. So,
Wow. But I wanted
by the
people to
way,
hear this, because I didn't want them to
we
miss
have.
it. It's a very it's a, I think it's a it's a it's a it's a pivotal cultural moment as much
Yes.
as it's a pivotal political moment.
And just to tell you a little bit about Austin, you get off at the airport, you go get your luggage under the statue of Barbara Jordan, you get on a bus, you cross Lady Bird Lake on Ann Richards Bridge. The first street you come, used to be First Street, it's now Cesar Chavez. Second
Wow.
street is Willie Nelson Boulevard.
Wow. Actually, thank you for that GPS. I love that. That was incredible. All right. And then last but not least, we actually discussed this on Race Class the other day. And it turns out that we were talking about anti-Semitism, despite the fact that the umbrella is Race Class, but there's a connection here. And it turns out that Governor Abbott has issued an executive order aimed at fighting what his office called an increase in anti-Semitism at Texas's colleges and universities. Well, just like we saw at the Republican Party of Texas and number four in the media credentials, how does Governor Abbott define anti-Semitism?
Well, you know, there's a great deal of irony because his primary campaign assault on the rural Republicans was largely coordinated with a group, this Defend Texas Liberty, that had the 7-hour meeting with Nick Fuentes, the Holocaust denier. The irony is it's tragic in a lot of ways. Regulating, well, we have not had the kind of anti-Semitic outbursts that that you've seen in some campuses, but we have seen a lot of anti-Semitism. And I have no idea how he plans to execute it. I think it's optics and cosmetics.
No, it is up. It's just like his push for vouchers. He never was a voucher guy, but it became part of the DNA of the Republican MAGA party that you had to embrace vouchers. Well, now it's part of the DNA of the Republican Party is to claim that you are going to be fighting against anti-Semitism, even though you sleep with anti-Semites, even though you take money from anti-Semites, even though
Now we're
probably behind the
anti-Semites.
scenes you're anti-Semitic. But now that has become why, in part, because of what's happening between Hamas and Bibi Netanyahu, and that it is hurting Joe Biden. Therefore, because it's hurting Joe Biden, you will do anything to support the mistakes being made by Bibi Netanyahu. And if anyone even suggests that Bibi Netanyahu is making a mistake, you're then labeled an anti-Semite. I mean, I just want to remind everyone. And what I said on Race Class, you're going to love this, Harvey, is that I started the show when we were talking about anti-Semitism. And I said, I just want to remind everyone that Israel is not a synagogue. Israel is a state. It is not a synagogue, it is a state. Bibi Netanyahu is not a rabbi, okay? He is a politician, All right. And if you want to criticize a politician, you have a right to do that and not be labeled anyone but saying this is really suck policy, you know. And it's so funny. And I'm this again, it seems sounds personal, but I remember one being the first female to run for governor. And when I lost the race for governor, here was my concern. Did women lose or did Arnie lose? And I didn't want women to lose. I wanted Arnie to lose. Well, guess what? Arnie lost. And that's the good news story. And that's my criticism of Bibi is not a religious criticism. It is a political criticism. And it will be interesting to see how Governor Abbott actually sort of fleshes out this executive order.
On this issue, 3 sessions ago, 6 years ago, they defunded the Holocaust Commission, which was mostly ceremonial, did not have a big budget, but they just.
All right, that's another one, another one. Anyway, Harvey Kronberg is joining us. If it's Friday, it must be Texas. Harvey is the publisher of The Quorum Report. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Both the current American president and his immediate predecessor have highlighted the need to invest in American infrastructure. They took different approaches to this. Donald Trump, the immediate predecessor of President Biden, chose to talk about this, not pass any legislation, and every now and then say that it was important or tweet about it, but do nothing. President Biden passed the most important and largest investment in American infrastructure in at least a generation. We have not yet seen all the fruits of that. In fact, many of those projects will begin soon. But that is doing something. Recently, we were all reminded of the need to invest in infrastructure because of this collapse of this bridge in Maryland after a ship hit it. And once again, we see the difference in the two-party approaches. The Democrats, admittedly the party in office right now, is trying to get money to fix the bridge, to repair the bridge, to help find people who died in this terrible accident. The Republicans are using coded racism to suggest that somehow this bridge collapsed because the mayor of Baltimore was African-American, is African-American. And if you're saying to yourself, that doesn't make any sense at all, you're right, except that it highlights that with the GOP, it always comes back to the racism. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
And this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record. on Thursday morning. We're being joined, as we are every Friday, by Bill Curry. He's an American lawyer and politician. He's been the two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut, Connecticut being the operative word today, Bill, and a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He was also the former head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
It's a pleasure. We are also being joined by Professor Adam Finkel. He is a clinical professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His research, writing, and advocacy focuses on a variety of occupational health problems, including CTE and football of late, environmental contamination. He is the dad of a 23-year-old daughter conceived in vitro, which makes him concerned about SCOTUS in Alabama and everywhere else, and the prospect of it going after IVF. Well, that you have to, you can't be concerned, Adam. They're going after IVF. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. She'll be 24 on Sunday.
Oh, mazel tov. All right, Bill. When we were talking just before you came on the air, you made an interesting connection. We know that Joe Lieberman recently passed away. I just mentioned that our Congresswoman, Annie McLean Custer, who is the co-chair of the conservative, pro-banking, pro-financial New Democrats, has decided after a number of years to retire. And then, of course, we're looking at a number of other situations that are going on around the country. And you wanted to sort of take a lot of these stories. Oh, and RFK Jr. and his decision to choose this unknown, attractive billionaire named Shanahan, who, by the way, is an anti-vaxxer and also had an affair with Elon Musk, which is why she got divorced from her husband, who is one of the founders of Google. I need to make sure I drop all these names because they're all connected. And yet you wanted to talk about, in some ways, how there's sort of this interesting Velcro that holds Annie and RFK and Lieberman and all these folks together, because there's a bit of a theme here. So I want you to sort of share with my audience what you saw that until you spoke it, I did not see.
And I'm not exactly sure what I see, but I'll just say that there are lots of configurations, both actual and potential, in our politics, lots of different coalitions, and lots of different sets of overlapping values, and that people vote in ways that are that the categories that we've always used of left and right and Democrat, Republican, can't really comprehend. And I'll just say very quickly, you know, and I point out to a lot of people who blamed Ralph Nader for Al Gore's loss that in 92, Ralph Nader got more votes from Republicans than Democrats in New Hampshire, the only state he ran in. And in 96, when I was in the Clinton White House, and I was liaison with Ralph, I met with Ralph every few weeks about what he was doing. And it seemed clear from the little data we could have on a race that small that he was getting more Republicans than Democrats then. I don't know why it wouldn't have continued to be true. And Ralph drew heaviest from the same voting districts that did well for Ross Perot, that had done well for Pat Buchanan. That there was a wide range of populist sentiment that didn't fit into our categories very well at all. And also, by the way, our failure to understand, I think, was a real key part of the Democrats' loss of much of the white working class over the last 30 years, and also of its own basic identity as a reformer and as a tribune standing up to corporate power. And now among libertarians and mystics and anti-vaxxers and garden variety populists, and in the midst of a policy vacuum from the government itself, a government paralyzed by the corruption of political money into doing nothing about the things people care about most, in that vacuum, all of these currents that we don't look at so closely are just roiling and forming and reforming. I'll just finish by saying, anyone who thinks they know from whom Robert Kennedy Jr. and Nicole Shanahan will draw the most votes has a much better crystal ball than I do, or just isn't really thinking.
What was so frightening for me is that you know, I wrote about RFK Jr. for Raw Story, and I referred to him as a MAGA Trojan horse. And that was a year ago, okay? And now I'm looking, and you made, I think, a really good point. You know, will he pull more away from Biden, or will he pull more away from Trump? But the stories now about money and the connection to money is that RFK Jr. chose Shanahan not because of her political portfolio, which she has none, but what she does have now in a political portfolio is what is essential to a political portfolio. It's checks with commas in them. Okay? That's the only thing that matters. And if you actually look at RFK, if you actually look at Donald Trump, if you actually look at a lot of these folks that we've been talking about, it turns out that the corruption of money and the essential nature of money has defined whatever kind of, I feel like they've all become a form of prostitute, except prostitutes are honest. These guys are dishonest. And then when I found out that Shanahan had actually had an affair with Elon Musk, which explains why she got a divorce from her husband, the co-founder of Google. And then you realize that she spent money on RFK Jr.'s huge advertisement during the, what was that, that big football game, whatever it's called. I mean, you just begin to go, oh,
it's called
my
the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, shut up. But whatever it was a $4 million ad she spent,
yes,
you know?
Was.
It's just, it's like, what does he stand for? What attracts populace, Adam Finkel? I understand they're angry. I get it. I am angry too. I feel abandoned too. I don't want to know that because I get sick, I could actually have to file for bankruptcy. Why? Because I got sick. I don't want to see that now the cost of my food is now eating more and more of what is my essential paycheck every month. I don't want to know that I can't afford my rent because it's going up so high. I don't want to know that my kid goes into enormous debt that I now refer to as the anti-dowry for going to college. There are so many things to be angry about, but I don't understand how that anger then gets focused on these phonies, these liars, these misogynists, these two-timers, these racists. How do you get from that anger to this crap? And it's crap that's running. It is not something with integrity. It is something that all I want to do is every time I open a page about them, I want to take a shower. But then I see the millions of these angry people following them. And I'm going, what is it about these hucksters that is attractive to you? And I'm asking you a lot, Adam Finkel, but I don't see the connection.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't find it attractive, but I have been thinking about him a lot lately. I've been working very closely with a very far right Republican legislator in New Hampshire who happens to be a fan of RFK's. And what I've learned is that, you know, the stop clock metaphor that, you know, I knew him a little bit 20 years ago. I'm an environmental scientist and you know, ran into him a couple times on the Hudson River issues. He was right. But if everything is a conspiracy theory and all you have is this, as you say, unfocused anger that everything is the man trying to do something to you, first of all, that's not a positive vision. There's no solution inherent in that. But also, I think we have to think about how the few times that you're right and they are sort of true positive signals of conspiracy, and this legislator and I, we have glommed onto a true conspiracy in New Hampshire about solid waste and landfilling and corruption and dirty money and all that stuff. She's absolutely right about that. But when everything's a conspiracy, the inchoate roiling at monsters under the bed does more harm than good, because if 1 out of 10 times you're right, you're spending 9/10 of your time on these quixotic fantasies that just both divert and do harm. So I see Kennedy as just all he is now is this rage. And that's really all Trump is too. And yeah, we need somebody who can focus the rage where it belongs, but not fall prey to every single wacky space laser conspiracy out there.
I have to talk to you, Bill Curry, about Joe Lieberman, because if anyone on this panel, maybe anyone that I've heard even on TV or on the air knows Joe Lieberman, it is in fact you, Bill Curry. Joe Lieberman was so interesting to me and so disappointing to me. And of course, my biggest concern about Joe Lieberman was his incredible over-the-top support for the war in Iraq. And I was just so appalled at that. That was the filter through everything I saw about Joe Lieberman. So not only was he quote unquote fiercely independent, only I'm not quite sure what that means, but then with his absolute sort of military streak, I was always questioning really what it was that he loved and what it was that he believed. You've known Joe Lieberman for a long time. So tell me a little bit about the arc of Joe, because the Joe that you knew initially was a Joe that you truly admired, and you even told me that.
And whom I liked very much as
Yes.
well. When I was 26 years old, I somehow got elected to the state Senate in Connecticut. And my first term there was his last. I was represented in the 9th district, he the 10th. So we sat next to each other for 2 years and got along fabulously. I thought he was funny. And he has, of course, a self-effacing style that has served him well throughout his career. And he helped me with lots of things that I was doing and was, on the whole, doubtless cautious, but a progressive. And the arc of his career went all in the wrong direction. It wasn't until the Iraq War that I finally broke with him, and I'd been involved in his campaigns, and he'd been involved supporting me. And it broke my heart. I would just say that he, for a variety of reasons, in 2004, he sought the presidency, the nomination. He began well ahead of the field because people liked him from 2000. And he made it very clear that he wanted the Democratic Party to support him and the Iraq War.
Yes.
And it was the least personal rejection I've ever seen in politics. The voters basically said, we still like you, but we're no longer supporting that. And we can't make you our nominee. And that year, a bitterness came into his voice. And he took that rejection. I truly believe that his own turn to the right was about opportunism, but also about a very deep sense of rejection over 2004. In 2006, he ran as independent. 2008, he endorsed McCain. He has the distinction of having played a major hand in the most awful decisions this country has made.
Yes.
Without him in the United States Senate, I do not believe George W. Bush could have rounded up the votes to authorize the Iraq War. He was the indispensable Democrat, and he brought him votes he otherwise could not have gotten, gave him political cover. It was the greatest foreign policy mistake in the history of our country, including even Vietnam. And without Joe, it couldn't have happened. And then I would just last say, when I was a comptroller in Connecticut, I introduced the first public option in the country. And I still believe it's the best road to universal health care. And we got it passed in the Senate and almost got it enacted. Joe said he loved it, endorsed it all over the place, endorsed the public option many times. And when we got a public option through the United States House of Representatives in 2010 onto the Senate floor with 53 votes in public support and needing only the 60th vote to overcome the filibuster, he didn't have to vote for the bill. Joe decided he'd been just kidding. And he was the 60th vote. We never got it. We never got a public option. If we had, we'd be close to universal health care at a much lower price today.
Yes.
And so I would just say health care is the major domestic policy issue. And Iraq is the major foreign policy issue. I could give you a long list, but he was the key player in taking us down the wrong road on both of those. And I don't think he really did. I think he did Iraq out of conviction. The public option was just powerful.
He wrapped himself up in this idea of being an independent. And I'll be honest with you, I describe myself as the radical middle, okay? I haven't left the Democratic Party. Sometimes it's hard to stay in the Democratic Party, but I never left it. He did.
I admired the fact, I didn't agree with the policy decisions Joe was making, but for a long time, I stayed with him, one, because I liked him, and two, I did believe that we had to find some way to bridge the differences. As you've heard me say, Democratic Party has to get bipartisan with itself.
Right.
And most of what we as progressives have hungered for all our lives, with a couple of small concessions, we could enact right now with the vast support, wide support of the American people. But that's not what he did. In his no labels fiasco, I would just point out, lastly, Joe's calling card was environmentalism for much of his career with liberals. In the no labels common sense platform, he doesn't even mention climate change.
Right.
He finds a center that doesn't include any environmentalists, any feminists, any labor leaders. Their coalition is all dark money, big corporate donors and lobbyists. It's not America's center. It's Washington's center. And that's the whole problem.
Yeah.
And he came to embody it.
I need to turn to you, Adam, because one of the things in your description is that your daughter will turn 24 this Sunday, but she is the result of IVF. She is that precious gift that we were able to get as a result of science. And I want to take the two stories, one that you wanted to talk about, which is the case before the United States Supreme Court about mifepristone, where clearly nobody had standing, but that didn't obviously matter. They still got to the Supreme Court. But what we learned is that this would be the first time ever that a court would overrule an FDA decision. So it's both shocking and everything else. But then, of course, in order to cover their proverbial butt, the two most conservative members of the court suddenly flipped from asking questions about standing to turning to the Comstock Act. But as I'm thinking about mifepristone, which is actually safer for everyone than Viagra, than aspirin, than Tylenol, I mean, I want the bumper sticker that says that. I'm thinking about you and IVF and that they were going down this incredible path, really about controlling women. But I want to connect that to what just happened in Alabama. Because when I heard about what happened in Alabama, one, I kept thinking, are you sure this was Alabama? And it turned out that the Democrats had a win in Alabama in a special election, and it was an early test for IVF as a campaign issue. Marilla Lanz, who defeated the Republican in a Republican district, highlighted IVF and abortion rights in her campaign for a state house seat that had been held by the GOP. Now, it wasn't the most ruby red of districts, but it was Alabama, okay? And this woman, from the minute she opened her mouth to the minute she closed her campaign, it was all about choice. It was all about abortion. It was all about IVF. She talked about her own abortion. And I'm looking at this like bizarre Supreme Court hearing about mifepristone. I'm looking at her win. I'm looking at what's happening in 2024 and what is going to be the message going forward. And I think one of the things that you heard, and you heard it from her, was that she said what was so interesting about my special election was how many women came out to vote. And I think that that's a powerful message here, that once we hear what is being taken away, which is more than just a right to control our bodies, it's actually our right to life. Because this is not just about having a baby. This is not just about having an abortion. This is about compromising our health, compromising our future, relegating us back to the kitchen to a place we don't even recognize anymore. And I think that whether you're a Republican, whether you're even a born again, you have to start paying attention to this. And I thought the decision or the oral arguments in the Supreme Court were both powerful and frightening.
Yeah, I do want to say one thing about your Lieberman as the Jewish guy on the panel. He was dyspeptic all the time, and the public option thing was unforgivable. I'm eligible for Medicare in a week, and I will be saving $17,000 a year by finally putting in for 40 years and getting what everybody should have. So unforgivable, and you know, he was the Susan Collins of our tribe, and she lauded him because they were the reliable scolds, always disappointed, always scolding, but never really useful, at least not in the 20 years that I've been following his career. So I read the mifepristone argument. You've heard me say on this show before that Amy Coney Barrett and the people who have faux religious beliefs about IVF and, you know, seven-day blastocysts that haven't even implanted yet, they are terrorists because they are trying to not only say who cannot be born, who must be born in the abortion debate, but who cannot be born in the contraception and IVF debate. And my wife and I spent 5 years trying to conceive, and IVF is actually not only a scientific miracle, and our daughters and many, many others are living proof of that, but it is actually a way to create fewer so-called excess embryos, which is the bane of the some of the Catholic fringe movement, because we lost far more excess embryos in the natural rush to conceive than we did once we turned to IVF. Wow. Because nature, the deity, whoever, was destroying our embryos 1 month at a time for four of those 5 years. Anyway, the oral argument was fascinating. I do think it's going to be a win for reason, but you never know with these folks. Sam Alito was clearly the farthest out, as he usually is, Yosemite Sam Alito. But they had no standing. These were doctors who could not claim that they had ever been or would ever be aggrieved by someone coming to their clinic or their emergency room having taken mifepristone, because of course there is a conscience exemption where none of them would have to perform a procedure that they didn't want to on someone who came in. And as you say, this drug is safer than a lot of things that we use, including Viagra. But as a former regulator at OSHA and EPA, the concern for us, as it were, in the argument was not just the standing issue, but whether the FDA could be have a rule remanded or overturned for being arbitrary and capricious. And we do want arbitrary and capricious decisions to be overturned. It's the cornerstone of our system, but they happen rarely. And this was clearly not. This was a data-driven, evidence-based decision 20 years ago, and then again 6 years ago or 8 years ago, to allow this drug to be used and to be sent over the mails. And I think the justices were all pretty clear that there was no cause to say that FDA had ignored public comment or used bad data or ignored data. This was just aggrieved people who Judge Jackson kept saying, I don't get it. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. You really just want everyone else to not do what you don't want them to do. And they really couldn't answer that, because that clearly was the whole point, scolding the rest of the country. Don't take this drug that we have some vague religious objection to. So I'm looking forward to a good decision out of this.
Well, you'll get a good decision, but another one will come back real quickly, and it won't be a good decision. But what I think is also interesting, and I don't know if you know about this, Bill, but some of those doctors that they were representing, some of those doctors were actually dentists. Just to let you know. I mean, it's like, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. And Josh Hawley's wife is the lead counsel on this case. Senator Josh Hawley, who everyone says, if Donald Trump becomes president of the United States, Josh Hawley is angling to become the attorney general. So I want to make sure that we put all these pieces together, because they are so frightening. They're so frightening. But Bill, we only have a few minutes left.
It's a painful irony when the anti-science party questions the science on which an agency has made a decision. They're just kidding. The science is solid. Plus, they know nothing about it and don't believe in science anyway.
That's right.
They just want to do this.
So what's really interesting is I saw a story at Salon.com, and we only have a few minutes left. I want to touch about the Baltimore Bridge collapse. And as soon as I read about the Baltimore Bridge collapse, and I read about the people that had died, they were from Mexico and Honduras and Salvador. And it didn't surprise me. And I thought, oh my God, of course. You know, if you're working late at night and you're filling potholes, probably you are not, you're not a Norwegian, all right? And you're probably, you might be part of the immigrant community, and you may be part of the undocumented immigrant community, because we find the connection between the jobs that people don't want to do and who in fact is doing them. All right. And so I immediately went to the whole question of immigration. It's interesting, because people at Fox News went there as well. But we came with two completely different conclusions, Bill. What the people at Fox News said was that this was a finger-pointing opportunity, that because of our wide-open immigration policy at the border could be a factor, because the cargo ship had been flying under a Singaporean flag. I mean, that they would take this and say it had to do with the wide-open border. Do you know what my reaction was? My reaction is, we don't have enough people to rebuild the infrastructure that we are now funding because of Joe Biden, to remanufacture and build the manufacturing plants. Who the hell is going to be available to rebuild this enormous, enormous bridge in Baltimore? If we don't start reconsidering our immigration policy, we are basically sort of inflicting these economic self-inflicting wounds, because we are not capable of doing what is necessary to make this country survive now or into the future.
Without immigrant labor,
yes,
we can't pick the food in the fields. We can't, yes, serve it in a restaurant. We can't, yes, build or take care of things. We also can't have doctors in our hospitals enough to treat us. And we can't have the raw talent in Silicon Valley that has gone into creating so many wonders. It is in every aspect, not just one. Every single aspect, right, of our economy is so dependent. I'll just say that I wish my, as I've said before, my favorite conservative of recent years is Angela Merkel, who in Germany took on the question of immigration and explained that these immigrants that people despise were holding up their social service system by pouring so much money into it and by providing younger workers, that they were indispensable to the economic future of the country. I wish the Democratic Party would clarify its commitment even further to legal immigration.
Thank you. Me too.
But I
me
wish too. It would also, and I wish it would also explain the actual economics of this decision to the American people who are so affected by it.
I need to say goodbye to my two fabulous guests, Bill Curry, an American lawyer and politician, and Professor Adam Finkel, a clinical professor of environmental health science at the University of Michigan. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for a fabulous Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We will schmooze on Monday, everyone. Ciao. Just